Her body tingled with dread. Is it my turn to watch?
No, no, we're good. I let you sleep.
Percy!
Hey, it's fine. Besides, I was too excited to sleep. Look!
Bob the Titan sat cross-legged by the altar, happily munching a piece of pizza. Annabeth rubbed her eyes, wondering if she was still dreaming.
Is that pepperoni?
Burnt offerings, Percy said. Sacrifices to Hermes from the mortal world, I guess. They appeared in a cloud of smoke. We've got half a hot dog, some grapes, a plate of roast beef, and a package of peanut M&Ms.
M&Ms for Bob, Bob said happily. That okay?
Annabeth didn't protest. Percy brought her the plate of roast beef and she wolfed it down. She'd never tasted anything so good. The brisket was still hot, with exactly the same spicy sweet glaze as the barbecue at Camp Half-Blood.
I know, said Percy, reading her expression. I think it is from Camp Half-Blood.
The idea made Annabeth giddy with homesickness. At every meal, the campers would burn a portion of their food to honor their godly parents. The smoke supposedly pleased the gods, but Annabeth had never thought about where the food went when it was burned. Maybe the offerings reappeared on the gods' altars in Olympus, or even here, in the middle of Tartarus.
Peanut M&Ms, Annabeth said. Connor Stoll always burned a pack for his dad at dinner.
She thought about sitting in the dining pavilion, watching the sunset over Long Island Sound. That was the first place she and Percy had truly kissed. Her eyes smarted. Percy put his hand on her shoulder.
Hey, this is good. Actual food from home, right?
She nodded. They finished eating in silence. Bob chomped down the last of his M&Ms.
Should go now. They will be here in a few minutes.
A few minutes?
Annabeth reached for her dagger, then remembered she didn't have it.
Yes. Well, I think minutes.
Bob scratched his silvery hair.
Time is hard in Tartarus. Not the same.
Percy crept to the edge of the crater. He peered back the way they'd come.
I don't see anything, but that doesn't mean much.
Bob, which giants are we talking about? Which titans?
Bob grunted.
Not sure of names. 6, maybe 7? I can sense them.
6 or 7?
Annabeth wasn't sure her barbecue would stay down.
And can they sense you?
Don't know.
Bob smiled.
Bob is different, but they can smell demigods, yes. You two smell very strong. Good strong, like buttery bread.
Buttery bread, Annabeth said. Well, that's great. Percy climbed back to the altar.
Is it possible to kill a giant in Tartarus? I mean, since we don't have a god to help us?
He looked at Annabeth as if she actually had an answer.
Percy, I don't know. Traveling in Tartarus, fighting monsters here? It's never been done before. Maybe Bob could help us kill a giant. Maybe a titan would count as a god? I just don't know.
Yeah, Percy said. Okay.
She could see the worry in his eyes. For years, he depended on her for answers. Now, when he needed her most, she couldn't help. She hated being so clueless, but nothing she'd ever learned at camp had prepared her for Tartarus. There was only one thing she was sure of. They had to keep moving. They couldn't be caught by 6 or 7 hostile immortals. She stood, still disoriented from her nightmares. Bob started cleaning up, collecting their trash in a little pile, using his squirt bottle to wipe off the altar.
Where to now? Annabeth asked.
Percy pointed at the stormy wall of darkness.
Bob says that way. Apparently the doors of death...
You told him?
Annabeth didn't mean it to come out so harsh, but Percy winced.
While you were asleep, he admitted. Annabeth, Bob can help. We need a guide.
Bob helps, Bob agreed. Into the Darklands, the doors of death. Walking straight to them would be bad. Too many monsters gathered there. Even Bob could not sweep that many. They would kill Percy and Annabeth in about 2 seconds.
The Titan frowned.
I think seconds.
Time is hard in Tartarus.
Right, Annabeth grumbled.
So was there another way?
Hiding, said Bob. The death mist could hide you.
Oh. Annabeth suddenly felt very small in the shadow of the Titan.
What is death mist?
It is dangerous, Bob said. But if the lady will give you death mist, it might hide you. If we can avoid night. The lady is very close to night. That is bad.
The lady, Percy repeated.
Yes.
Bob pointed ahead of them into the inky blackness.
We should go.
Percy glanced at Annabeth, obviously hoping for guidance, but she had none. She was thinking about her nightmare. Thalia's tree splintered by lightning, Gia rising on the hillside and unleashing her monsters on Camp Half-Blood.
Okay then, Percy said. I guess we'll see a lady about some death mist.
Wait, Annabeth said. Her mind was buzzing. She thought of her dream about Luke and Thalia. She recalled the stories Luke had told her about his father, Hermes, god of travelers, guide to the spirits of the dead, god of communication. She stared at the black altar.
Annabeth?
Percy sounded concerned. She walked to the pile of trash and picked out a reasonably clean paper napkin. She remembered her vision of Reyna standing in the smoking crevice beneath the ruins of Thalia's pine tree, speaking with the voice of Athena.
I must stand here. The Roman must bring me. Hurry! The message must be sent.
Bob, she said. Offerings burned in the mortal world appear on this altar, right?
Bob frowned uncomfortably, like he wasn't ready for a pop quiz.
Yes.
So what happens if I burn something on the altar here?
That's all right, Annabeth said. You don't know. Nobody knows, because it's never been done. There was a chance, she thought. Just the slimmest chance that an offering burned on this altar might appear at Camp Half-Blood. Doubtful, but if it did work...
Annabeth, Percy said again, you're planning something. You've got that I'm planning something look.
I don't have an I'm planning something look.
Yeah, you totally do. Your eyebrows knit and your lips pressed together and...
Do you have a pen? She asked him.
You're kidding, right?
He brought out Riptide.
Yes, but can you actually write with it?
I don't know, he admitted. Never tried.
He uncapped the pen. As usual, it sprang into a full-sized sword. Annabeth had watched him do this hundreds of times. Normally, when he fought... Percy simply discarded the cap. It always appeared in his pocket later, as needed. When he touched the cap to the point of the sword, it would turn back into a ballpoint pen.
What if you touch the cap to the other end of the sword? Annabeth said. Like where you'd put the cap if you were actually going to write with the pen.
Percy
looked doubtful. But he touched the cap to the hilt of the sword. Riptide shrank back into a ballpoint pen, but now the writing point was exposed.
May I?
Annabeth plucked it from his hand. She flattened the napkin against the altar and began to write. Riptide's ink glowed celestial bronze.
"What are you doing?" Percy asked.
"Sending a message," Annabeth said. "I just hope Rachel gets it."
"Rachel?" Percy asked.
"You mean our Rachel? Oracle of Delphi Rachel?"
"That's the one." Annabeth suppressed a smile. Whenever she brought up Rachel's name, Percy got nervous. At one point, Rachel had been interested in dating Percy. That was ancient history. Rachel and Annabeth were good friends now. But Annabeth didn't mind making Percy a little uneasy. You had to keep your boyfriend on his toes. Annabeth finished her note and folded the napkin. On the outside, she wrote, "Connor, give this to Rachel. Not a prank. Don't be a moron. Love, Annabeth." She took a deep breath. She was asking Rachel Dare to do something ridiculously dangerous, but it was the only way she could think of to communicate with the Romans, the only way that might avoid bloodshed.
"Now I just need to burn it," she said. "Anybody got a match?"
The point of Bob's spear shot from his broom handle. It sparked against the altar and erupted in silvery fire.
Thanks.
Annabeth lit the napkin and set it on the altar. She watched it crumble to ash and wondered if she was crazy. Could the smoke really make it out of Tartarus?
"We should go now," Bob advised. "Really, really go, before we are killed."
Annabeth stared at the wall of blackness in front of them. Somewhere in there was a lady who dispensed a death mist that might hide them from monsters. A plan recommended by a titan, one of their bitterest enemies. Another dose of weirdness to explode her brain.
"Right," she said. "I'm ready."
Chapter 23. Annabeth. Annabeth literally stumbled over the second titan. After entering the storm front, they plodded on for what seemed like hours, relying on the light of Percy's celestial bronze blade and on Bob, who glowed faintly in the dark like some sort of crazy janitor angel. Annabeth could only see about 5 feet in front of her. In a strange way, the dark lands reminded her of San Francisco, where her dad lived, on those summer afternoons when the fog bank rolled in like cold, wet packing material and swallowed Pacific Heights. Except here in Tartarus, the fog was made of ink. Rocks loomed out of nowhere, pits appeared at their feet, and Annabeth barely avoided falling in. Monstrous roars echoed in the gloom, but Annabeth couldn't tell where they came from. All she could be certain of was that the terrain was still sloping down. Down seemed to be the only direction allowed in Tartarus. If Annabeth backtracked even a step, she felt tired and heavy, as if gravity were increasing to discourage her. Assuming that the entire pit was the body of Tartarus, Annabeth had a nasty feeling they were marching straight down his throat. She was so preoccupied with that thought, she didn't notice the ledge until it was too late. Percy yelled, "Whoa!" He grabbed for her arm, but she was already falling. Fortunately, it was only a shallow depression. Most of it was filled with a monster blister. She had a soft landing on a warm, bouncy surface and was feeling lucky, until she opened her eyes and found herself staring through a glowing gold membrane at another, much larger face. She screamed and flailed, toppling sideways off the mound. Her heart did 100 jumping jacks. Percy helped her to her feet.
"You okay?"
She didn't trust herself to answer. If she opened her mouth, she might scream again, and that would be undignified. She was a daughter of Athena, not some shrill, girly victim in a horror movie. But gods of Olympus, Curled in the membrane bubble in front of her was a fully formed titan in golden armor, his skin the color of polished pennies. His eyes were closed, but he scowled so deeply he appeared to be on the verge of a blood-curdling war cry. Even through the blister, Annabeth could feel the heat radiating from his body.
"Hyperion," Percy said. "I hate that guy."
Annabeth's shoulder suddenly ached from an old wound. During the Battle of Manhattan, Percy had fought this titan at the reservoir, water against fire. It had been the first time Percy had summoned a hurricane, which wasn't something Annabeth would ever forget.
"I thought Grover turned this guy into a maple tree."
"Yeah," Percy agreed. "Maybe the maple tree died and he wound up back here."
Annabeth remembered how Hyperion had summoned fiery explosions and how many satyrs and nymphs he'd destroyed before Percy and Grover stopped him. She was about to suggest that they burst Hyperion's bubble before he woke up. He looked ready to pop out at any moment and start charbroiling everything in his path. Then she glanced at Bob. The silvery titan was studying Hyperion with a frown of concentration. Maybe recognition. Their faces looked so much alike. Annabeth bit back a curse. Of course they looked alike. Hyperion was his brother. Hyperion was the Titan Lord of the East. Iapetus, Bob, was the Lord of the West. Take away Bob's broom and his janitor's clothes, put him in armor and cut his hair, change his color scheme from silver to gold, and Iapetus would have been almost indistinguishable from Hyperion.
"Bob," she said, "we should go."
"Gold, not silver," Bob murmured. "But he looks like me."
"Bob," Percy said. "Hey, buddy, over here."
The Titan reluctantly turned.
"Am I your friend?" Percy asked.
"Yes."
Bob sounded dangerously uncertain.
"We are friends."
"You know that some monsters are good," Percy said, "and some are bad."
"Hmm,"
Bob said.
"Like, the pretty ghost ladies who serve Persephone are good. Exploding zombies are bad."
"Right," Percy said. "And some mortals are good, and some are bad. Well, the same thing is true for titans."
"Titans."
Bob loomed over them, glowering. Annabeth was pretty sure her boyfriend had just made a big mistake.
"That's what you are," Percy said calmly. "Bob the Titan. You're good. You're awesome, in fact. But some titans are not. This guy here, Hyperion, is full on bad. He tried to kill me. Tried to kill a lot of people."
Bob blinked his silver eyes.
"But he looks... his face is so..."
"He looks like you," Percy agreed. "He's a titan, like you. But he's not good like you are."
"Bob is good."
His fingers tightened on his broom handle.
"Yes, there is always at least one good one. Monsters, titans, giants."
Percy grimaced. "Well, I'm not sure about the giants."
"Oh, yes," Bob nodded earnestly.
Annabeth sensed they'd already been in this place too long. Their pursuers would be closing in.
"We should go," she urged. "What do we do about..."
"Bob," Percy said, "it's your call. Hyperion is your kind. We could leave him alone, but if he wakes up..."
Bob's broom spear swept into motion. If he'd been aiming at Annabeth or Percy, they would have been cut in half. Instead, Bob slashed through the monstrous blister, which burst in a geyser of hot golden mud. Annabeth wiped the Titan sludge out of her eyes. Where Hyperion had been, there was nothing but a smoking crater.
"Hyperion is a bad Titan," Bob announced, his expression grim. "Now he can't hurt my friends. He will have to reform somewhere else in Tartarus. Hopefully it will take a long time."
The Titan's eyes seemed brighter than usual, as if he were about to cry quicksilver.
"Thank you, Bob," Percy said.
How was he keeping his cool? The way he talked to Bob left Annabeth awestruck, and maybe a little uneasy, too. If Percy had been serious about leaving the choice to Bob, then she didn't like how much he trusted the Titan. If he'd been manipulating Bob into making that choice, well then, Annabeth was stunned that Percy could be so calculating. He met her eyes, but she couldn't read his expression. That bothered her, too.
"We'd better keep going," he said.
She and Percy followed Bob, the golden mud flecks from Hyperion's burst bubble glowing on his janitor's uniform. Chapter 24. Annabeth. After a while, Annabeth's feet felt like Titan mush. She marched along, following Bob, listening to the monotonous slosh of liquid in his cleaning bottle. "Stay alert," she told herself, but it was hard. Her thoughts were as numb as her legs. From time to time, Percy took her hand or made an encouraging comment, but she could tell the dark landscape was getting to him as well. His eyes had a dull sheen, like his spirit was being slowly extinguished.
"He fell into Tartarus to be with you," said a voice in her head. "If he dies, it will be your fault."
"Stop it," she said aloud. Percy frowned.
"What?"
"No, not you."
She tried for a reassuring smile, but she couldn't quite muster one.
"Talking to myself, this place, it's messing with my mind, giving me dark thoughts."
The worry lines deepened around Percy's sea-green eyes.
"Hey, Bob, where exactly are we heading?"
"The lady," Bob said. "Death Mist."
Annabeth fought down her irritation.
"But what does that mean? Who is this lady?"
"Naming her?" Bob glanced back. "Not a good idea."
Annabeth sighed. The Titan was right. Names had power, and speaking them here in Tartarus was probably very dangerous.
"Can you at least tell us how far?" she asked.
"I do not know," Bob admitted. "I can only feel it. We wait for the darkness to get darker. Then we go sideways."
"Sideways," Annabeth muttered. "Naturally." She was tempted to ask for a rest, but she didn't want to stop. Not here in this cold, dark place. The black fog seeped into her body, turning her bones into moist styrofoam. She wondered if her message would get to Rachel Dare, if Rachel could somehow carry her proposal to Reyna without getting killed in the process.
"A ridiculous hope," said the voice in her head. "You have only put Rachel in danger. Even if she finds the Romans, why should Reyna trust you after all that has happened?"
Annabeth was tempted to shout back at the voice, but she resisted. Even if she were going crazy, she didn't want to look like she was going crazy. She desperately needed something to lift her spirits. A drink of actual water, a moment of sunlight, a warm bed, a kind word from her mother. Suddenly, Bob stopped. He raised his hand. "Wait."
"What?"
Percy whispered.
"Shh,"
Bob warned.
"Ahead. Something moves."
Annabeth strained her ears. From somewhere in the fog came a deep thrumming noise, like the idling engine of a large construction vehicle. She could feel the vibrations through her shoes.
"We will surround it," Bob whispered. "Each of you take a flank."
For the millionth time, Annabeth wished she had her dagger. She picked up a chunk of jagged black obsidian and crept to the left. Percy went right, his sword ready. Bob took the middle, his spearhead glowing in the fog. The humming got louder, shaking the gravel at Annabeth's feet. The noise seemed to be coming from immediately in front of them.
"Ready?"
Bob murmured. Annabeth crouched, preparing to spring.
"On three?"
"One,"
Percy whispered.
"Two."
A figure appeared in the fog. Bob raised his spear.
"Wait!"
Annabeth shrieked. Bob froze just in time, the point of his spear hovering an inch above the head of a tiny calico kitten.
"Row,"
said the kitten, clearly unimpressed by their attack plan. It butted its head against Bob's foot and purred loudly. It seemed impossible, but the deep rumbling sound was coming from the kitten. As it purred, the ground vibrated and pebbles danced. The kitten fixed its yellow, lamp-like eyes on one particular rock, right between Annabeth's feet, and pounced. The cat could have been a demon or a horrible underworld monster in disguise, but Annabeth couldn't help it. She picked it up and cuddled it. The little thing was bony under its fur, but otherwise it seemed perfectly normal.
"How did..."
She couldn't even form the question.
"What is a kitten doing?"
The cat grew impatient and squirmed out of her arms. It landed with a thump, padded over to Bob, and started purring again as it rubbed against his boots. Percy laughed.
"Somebody likes you, Bob."
"It must be a good monster."
Bob looked up nervously.
"Isn't it?"
Annabeth felt a lump in her throat. Seeing the huge titan and this tiny kitten together, she suddenly felt insignificant compared to the vastness of Tartarus. This place had no respect for anything, good or bad, small or large, wise or unwise. Tartarus swallowed titans and demigods and kittens indiscriminately. Bob knelt down and scooped up the cat. It fit perfectly in Bob's palm, but it decided to explore. It climbed the Titan's arm, made itself at home on his shoulder, and closed its eyes, purring like an earth mover. Suddenly, its fur shimmered. In a flash, the kitten became a ghostly skeleton, as if it had stepped behind an X-ray machine. Then, it was a regular kitten again. Annabeth blinked.
"Did you see?"
"Yeah."
Percy knit his eyebrows.
"Oh, man. I know that kitten. It's one of the ones from the Smithsonian."
Annabeth tried to make sense of that. She'd never been to the Smithsonian with Percy. Then she recalled several years ago when the Titan Atlas had captured her. Percy and Thalia had led a quest to rescue her. Along the way, they'd watched Atlas raise some skeleton warriors from dragon teeth in the Smithsonian Museum. According to Percy, the Titan's first attempt went wrong. He'd planted saber-toothed tiger teeth by mistake and raised a batch of skeleton kittens from the soil.
"That's one of them?" Annabeth asked. "How did it get here?"
Percy spread his hands helplessly.
"Atlas told his servants to take the kittens away. Maybe they destroyed the cats and they were reborn in Tartarus. I don't know."
"It's cute,"
Bob said as the kitten sniffed his ear.
"But is it safe?"
Annabeth asked. The Titan scratched the kitten's chin. Annabeth didn't know if it was a good idea, carrying around a cat grown from a prehistoric tooth. But obviously it didn't matter now. The Titan and the cat had bonded.
"I will call him Small Bob," said Bob. "He is a good monster."
End of discussion. The Titan hefted his spear and they continued marching into the gloom. Annabeth walked in a daze, trying not to think about pizza. To keep herself distracted, she watched Small Bob, the kitten, pacing across Bob's shoulders and purring, occasionally turning into a glowing kitty skeleton, and then back to a calico fuzzball.
"Here," Bob announced.
He stopped so suddenly, Annabeth almost ran into him. Bob stared off to their left, as if deep in thought.
"Is this the place?" Annabeth asked. "Where we go sideways?"
"Yes," Bob agreed. "Darker than sideways."
Annabeth couldn't tell if it was actually darker, but the air did seem colder and thicker, as if they'd stepped into a different microclimate. Again, she was reminded of San Francisco, where you could walk from one neighborhood to the next, and the temperature might drop 10 degrees. She wondered if the Titans had built their palace on Mount Tamalpais because the Bay Area reminded them of Tartarus. What a depressing thought. Only Titans would see such a beautiful place as a potential outpost of the abyss. A hellish home away from home. Bob struck off to the left. They followed. The air definitely got colder. Annabeth pressed against Percy for warmth. He put his arm around her. It felt good being close to him, but she couldn't relax. They'd entered some sort of forest. Towering black trees soared into the gloom, perfectly round and bare of branches, like monstrous hair follicles. The ground was smooth and pale. With our luck, Annabeth thought, we're marching through the armpit of Tartarus. Suddenly, her senses were on high alert, as if somebody had snapped a rubber band against the base of her neck. She rested her hand on the trunk of the nearest tree.
"What is it?"
Percy raised his sword. Bob turned and looked back, confused.
"We are stopping?"
Annabeth held up her hand for silence. She wasn't sure what had set her off. Nothing looked different. Then she realized the tree trunk was quivering. She wondered momentarily if it was the kitten's purr, but Small Bob had fallen asleep on Large Bob's shoulder. A few yards away, another tree shuddered.
"Something's moving above us," Annabeth whispered. "Gather up."
Bob and Percy closed ranks with her, standing back to back. Annabeth strained her eyes, trying to see above them in the dark, but nothing moved. She had almost decided she was being paranoid when the first monster dropped to the ground only 5 feet away. Annabeth's first thought? The Furies. The creature looked almost exactly like one, a wrinkled hag with bat-like wings, brass talons, and glowing red eyes. She wore a tattered dress of black silk, and her face was twisted and ravenous, like a demonic grandmother in the mood to kill. Bob grunted as another one dropped in front of him, and then another in front of Percy. Soon, there were half a dozen surrounding them. More hissed in the trees above. They couldn't be Furies, then. There were only 3 of those, and these winged hags didn't carry whips. That didn't comfort Annabeth. The monster's talons looked plenty dangerous.
"What are you?"
she demanded.
"The Arai," hissed a voice. "The curses."
Annabeth tried to locate the speaker, but none of the demons had moved their mouths. Their eyes looked dead. Their expressions were frozen, like a puppet's. The voice simply floated overhead like a movie narrator, as if a single mind controlled all the creatures.
What do you want?
Annabeth asked, trying to maintain a tone of confidence. The voice cackled maliciously.
To curse you, of course. To destroy you 1,000 times in the name of Mother Night.
Only 1,000 times? Percy murmured. Oh, good. I thought we were in trouble. The circle of demon ladies closed in. Chapter 25. Hazel. Everything smelled like poison. 2 days after leaving Venice, Hazel still couldn't get the noxious scent of Eau de Cow Monster out of her nose. The seasickness didn't help. The Argo II sailed down the Adriatic, a beautiful, glittering expanse of blue, but Hazel couldn't appreciate it, thanks to the constant rolling of the ship. Above deck, she tried to keep her eyes fixed on the horizon, the white cliffs that always seemed just a mile or so to the east. What country was that? Croatia? She wasn't sure. She just wished she were on solid ground again. The thing that nauseated her most was the weasel. Last night, Hecate's pet Gale had appeared in her cabin. Hazel woke from a nightmare thinking, "What is that smell?" She found a furry rodent propped on her chest, staring at her with its beady black eyes. Nothing like waking up screaming, kicking off your covers, and dancing around your cabin while a weasel scampers between your feet, screeching and farting. Her friends rushed to her room to see if she was okay. The weasel was difficult to explain. Hazel could tell that Leo was trying hard not to make a joke. In the morning, once the excitement died down, Hazel decided to visit Coach Hedge, since he could talk to animals. She'd found his cabin door ajar and heard the coach inside, talking as if he were on the phone with someone, except they had no phones on board. Maybe he was sending a magical iris message? Hazel had heard that the Greeks used those a lot.
Sure, hun, Hedge was saying. Yeah, I know, baby. No, it's great news, but...
His voice broke with emotion. Hazel suddenly felt horrible for eavesdropping. She would have backed away, but Gale squeaked at her heels. Hazel knocked on the coach's door. Hedge poked his head out, scowling as usual, but his eyes were red.
What?
He growled. Sorry, Hazel said. Are you okay? The coach snorted and opened his door wide.
Kind of question is that?
There was no one else in the room. Hazel tried to remember why she was there.
I wondered if you could talk to my weasel.
The coach's eyes narrowed. He lowered his voice.
Are we speaking in code? Is there an intruder aboard?
Well, sort of. Gale peeked out from behind Hazel's feet and started chattering. The coach looked offended. He chattered back at the weasel. They had what sounded like a very intense argument.
What did she say? Hazel asked.
A lot of rude things, grumbled the satyr. The gist of it, she's here to see how it goes.
How what goes?
Coach Hedge stomped his hoof.
How am I supposed to know? She's a polecat. They never give a straight answer. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got, stuff.
He closed the door in her face. After breakfast, Hazel stood at the port rail, trying to settle her stomach. Next to her, Gale ran up and down the railing, passing gas. But the strong wind off the Adriatic helped whisk it away. Hazel wondered what was wrong with Coach Hedge. He must have been using an iris message to talk with someone, but if he'd gotten great news, why had he looked so devastated? She'd never seen him so shaken up. Unfortunately, she doubted the coach would ask for help if he needed it. He wasn't exactly the warm and open type. She stared at the white cliffs in the distance and thought about why Hecate had sent Gale the polecat.
She's here to see how it goes.
Something was about to happen. Hazel would be tested. She didn't understand how she was supposed to learn magic with no training. Hecate expected her to defeat some super powerful sorceress, the lady in the gold dress, whom Leo had described from his dream. But how? Hazel had spent all her free time trying to figure that out. She'd stared at her spatha, trying to make it look like a walking stick. She'd tried to summon a cloud to hide the full moon. She'd concentrated until her eyes crossed and her ears popped, but nothing happened. She couldn't manipulate the mist. The last few nights, her dreams had gotten worse. She found herself back in the fields of Asphodel, drifting aimlessly among the ghosts. Then she was in Gia's cave in Alaska, where Hazel and her mother had died as the ceiling collapsed and the voice of the Earth Goddess wailed in anger. She was on the stairs of her mother's apartment building in New Orleans, face to face with her father, Pluto. His cold fingers gripped her arm. The fabric of his black wool suit writhed with imprisoned souls. He fixed her with his dark, angry eyes and said,
"The dead see what they believe they will see. So do the living. That is the secret."
He'd never said that to her in real life. She had no idea what it meant. The worst nightmares seemed like glimpses of the future. Hazel was stumbling through a dark tunnel while a woman's laughter echoed around her.
"Control this if you can, child of Pluto," the woman taunted.
And always, Hazel dreamed about the images she'd seen at Hecate's crossroads. Leo falling through the sky, Percy and Annabeth lying unconscious, possibly dead, in front of black metal doors, and a shrouded figure looming above them, the giant Clytius wrapped in darkness. Next to her, on the rail, Gale the weasel chittered impatiently. Hazel was tempted to push the stupid rodent into the sea.
"I can't even control my own dreams," she wanted to scream. "How am I supposed to control the mist?"
She was so miserable, she didn't notice Frank until he was standing at her side.
"Feeling any better?" he asked.
He took her hand, his fingers completely covering hers. She couldn't believe how much taller he'd gotten. He had changed into so many animals, she wasn't sure why one more transformation should amaze her. But suddenly he'd grown into his weight. No one could call him pudgy or cuddly anymore. He looked like a football player, solid and strong, with a new center of gravity. His shoulders had broadened. He walked with more confidence. What Frank had done on that bridge in Venice, Hazel was still in awe. None of them had actually seen the battle, but no one doubted it. Frank's whole bearing had changed. Even Leo had stopped making jokes at his expense.
I'm all right, Hazel managed. You?
He smiled, the corners of his eyes crinkling.
I'm taller. Otherwise, yeah, I'm good. I haven't really, changed inside.
His voice held a little of the old doubt and awkwardness. The voice of her Frank, who always worried about being a klutz and messing up. Hazel felt relieved. She liked that part of him. At first, his new appearance had shocked her. She'd been worried that his personality had changed as well. Now she was starting to relax about that. Despite all his strength, Frank was the same sweet guy. He was still vulnerable. He still trusted her with his biggest weakness, the piece of magical firewood she carried in her coat pocket, next to her heart.
"I know, and I'm glad."
She squeezed his hand. It's actually not you I'm worried about. Frank grunted.
How's Nico doing?
She'd been thinking about herself, not Nico, but she followed Frank's gaze to the top of the foremast, where Nico was perched on the yardarm. Nico claimed that he liked to keep watch because he had good eyes. Hazel knew that wasn't the reason. The top of the mast was one of the few places on board where Nico could be alone. The others had offered him the use of Percy's cabin, since Percy was, well, absent. Nico adamantly refused. He spent most of his time up in the rigging, where he didn't have to talk with the rest of the crew. Since he'd been turned into a corn plant in Venice, he'd only gotten more reclusive and morose.
I don't know, Hazel admitted. He's been through a lot. Getting captured in Tartarus, being held prisoner in that bronze jar, watching Percy and Annabeth fall, and promising to lead us to Epirus.
Frank nodded.
I get the feeling Nico doesn't play well with others.
Frank stood up straight. He was wearing a beige t-shirt with a picture of a horse and the words Palio di Siena. He'd only bought it a couple days ago, but now it was too small. When he stretched, his midriff was exposed. Hazel realized she was staring. She quickly looked away, her face flushed.
Nico is my only relative, she said. He's not easy to like, but thanks for being kind to him.
Frank smiled.
Hey, you put up with my grandmother in Vancouver. Talk about not easy to like.
I loved your grandmother.
Gale the polecat scampered up to them, farted, and ran away.
Ugh.
Frank waved away the smell.
Why is that thing here anyway?
Hazel was almost glad she wasn't on dry land. As agitated as she felt, golden gems would probably be popping up all around her feet.
Hecate sent Gale to observe, she said.
Observe what?
Hazel tried to take comfort in Frank's presence, his new aura of solidity and strength.
I don't know, she said at last. Some kind of test.
Suddenly, the boat lurched forward. Chapter 26. Hazel. Hazel and Frank tumbled over each other. Hazel accidentally gave herself a Heimlich maneuver with the pommel of her sword and curled on the deck, moaning and coughing up the taste of Catobleps poison. Through a fog of pain, she heard the ship's figurehead, Festus, the bronze dragon, creaking in alarm and shooting fire. Dimly, Hazel wondered if they'd hit an iceberg. But in the Adriatic? In the middle of summer? The ship rocked to port with a massive commotion, like telephone poles snapping in half.
Gah!
Leo yelled somewhere behind her.
It's eating the oars!
What is? Hazel wondered. She tried to stand, but something large and heavy was pinning her legs. She realized it was Frank, grumbling as he tried to extract himself from a pile of loose rope. Everyone else was scrambling. Jason jumped over them, his sword drawn, and raced toward the stern. Piper was already on the quarterdeck, shooting food from her cornucopia and yelling,
Hey! Hey! Eat this, you stupid turtle!
Turtle? Frank helped Hazel to her feet.
You okay?
Yeah.
Hazel lied, clutching her stomach.
Go!
Frank sprinted up the steps, slinging off his backpack, which instantly transformed into a bow and quiver. By the time he reached the helm, he had already fired one arrow and was knocking the second. Leo frantically worked the ship's controls.
Oars won't retract! Get it away! Get it away!
Up in the rigging, Nico's face was slack with shock.
Styx, it's huge!
He yelled.
port! Go port!
Coach Hedge was the last one on deck. He compensated for that with enthusiasm. He bounded up the steps, waving his baseball bat, and without hesitation, Goat galloped to the stern and leaped over the rail with a gleeful, "Ha-ha!" Hazel staggered toward the quarterdeck to join her friends. The boat shuddered. More oars snapped, and Leal yelled,
"No, no, no!
Dang slimy shelled son of a mother!"
Hazel reached the stern and couldn't believe what she saw. When she heard the word turtle, she thought of a cute little thing the size of a jewelry box, sitting on a rock in the middle of a fish pond. When she heard huge turtle, her mind tried to adjust. Okay, perhaps it was like the Galapagos tortoise she'd seen in the zoo once, with a shell big enough to ride on. She did not envision a creature the size of an island. When she saw the massive dome of craggy black and brown squares, the word turtle simply did not compute. Its shell was more like a landmass. Hills of bone, shiny pearl valleys, kelp and moss forests, rivers of seawater trickling down the grooves of its carapace. On the ship's starboard side, another part of the monster rose from the water like a submarine. Larry's of Rome. Was that its head? Its gold eyes were the size of wading pools, with dark sideways slits for pupils. Its skin glistened like wet army camouflage, brown flecked with green and yellow. Its red, toothless mouth could have swallowed the Athena Parthenos in one bite. Hazel watched as it snapped off half a dozen oars.
"Stop that!"
Leo wailed. Coach Hedge clambered around the turtle's shell, whacking it uselessly with his baseball bat and yelling,
"Take that! And that!"
Jason flew from the stern and landed on the creature's head. He stabbed his golden sword straight between its eyes, but the blade slipped sideways, as if the turtle's skin were greased steel. Frank shot arrows at the monster's eyes with no success. The turtle's filmy inner eyelids blinked with uncanny precision, deflecting each shot. Piper shot cantaloupes into the water, yelling,
"Fetch, you stupid turtle!"
But the turtle seemed fixated on eating the Argo II.
"How did it get so close?"
Hazel demanded. Leo threw his hands up in exasperation.
"Must be that shell. Guess it's invisible to sonar. It's a freaking stealth turtle."
"Can the ship fly?"
Piper asked.
"With half our oars broken off?"
Leo punched some buttons and spun his Archimedes sphere.
"I'll have to try something else."
"There!" Nico yelled from above. "Can you get us to those straits?"
Hazel looked where he was pointing. About half a mile to the east, a long strip of land ran parallel to the coastal cliffs. It was hard to be sure from a distance, but the stretch of water between them looked to be only 20 or 30 yards across, possibly wide enough for the Argo II to slip through, but definitely not wide enough for the giant turtle's shell.
"Yeah, yeah."
Leo apparently understood. He turned the Archimedes sphere.
"Jason, get away from that thing's head. I have an idea."
Jason was still hacking away at the turtle's face, but when he heard Leo say, "I have an idea," he made the only smart choice. He flew away as fast as possible.
"Coach, come on,"
Jason said.
"No, I got this,"
Hedge said. But Jason grabbed him around the waist and took off. Unfortunately, the coach struggled so much that Jason's sword fell out of his hand and splashed into the sea.
"Coach!"
Jason complained.
"What?"
Hedge said.
"I was softening him up."
The turtle head-butted the hole, almost tossing the whole crew off the port side. Hazel heard a cracking sound, like the keel had splintered.
"Just another minute,"
Leo said, his hands flying over the console.
"We might not be here in another minute."
Frank fired his last arrow. Piper yelled at the turtle,
"Go away!"
For a moment, it actually worked. The turtle turned from the ship and dipped its head underwater. But then it came right back and rammed them even harder. Jason and Coach Hedge landed on the deck.
"You all right?"
Piper asked.
"Fine," Jason muttered. "Without a weapon, but fine."
"Fire in the shell!"
Leo cried, spinning his Wii controller. Hazel thought the stern had exploded. Jets of fire blasted out behind them, washing over the turtle's head. The ship shot forward and threw Hazel to the deck again. She hauled herself up and saw that the ship was bouncing over the waves at incredible speed, trailing fire like a rocket. The turtle was already 100 yards behind them, its head charred and smoking. The monster bellowed in frustration and started after them, its paddle feet scooping through the water with such power that it actually started to gain on them. The entrance to the straits was still a quarter mile ahead.
"A distraction," Leo muttered. "We'll never make it unless we get a distraction."
"A distraction," Hazel repeated. She concentrated and thought,
"Orion."
She had no idea whether it would work, but instantly, Hazel spotted something on the horizon, a flash of light and steam. It streaked across the surface of the Adriatic. In a heartbeat, Orion stood on the quarterdeck.
"Gods of Olympus," Hazel thought. "I love this horse."
Orion snorted as if to say, "Of course you do. You're not stupid." Hazel climbed on his back.
"Piper, I could use that charm speak of yours."
"Once upon a time, I liked turtles," Piper muttered, accepting a hand up. "Not anymore." Hazel spurred Orion. He leaped over the side of the boat, hitting the water at a full gallop. The turtle was a fast swimmer, but it couldn't match Orion's speed. Hazel and Piper zipped around the monster's head, Hazel slicing with her sword, Piper shouting random commands like,
"Dive! Turn left! Look behind you!"
The sword did no damage. Each command only worked for a moment, but they were making the turtle very annoyed. Orion whinnied derisively as the turtle snapped at him, only to get a mouthful of horse vapor. Soon, the monster had completely forgotten the Argo II. Hazel kept stabbing at its head. Piper kept yelling commands and using her cornucopia to bounce coconuts and roasted chickens off the turtle's eyeballs. As soon as the Argo II had passed into the straits, Orion broke off his harassment. They sped after the ship, and a moment later were back on deck. The rocket fire had extinguished, though smoking bronze exhaust vents still jutted from the stern. The Argo II limped forward under sail power, but their plan had paid off. They were safely harbored in the narrow waters, with a long, rocky island to starboard and the sheer white cliffs of the mainland to port. The turtle stopped at the entrance to the strait and glared at them balefully, but it made no attempt to follow. Its shell was obviously much too wide. Hazel dismounted and got a big hug from Frank.
"Nice work out there," he said.
Her face flushed.
"Thanks."
Piper slid down next to her.
"Leo, since when do we have jet propulsion?"
You know. Leo tried to look modest and failed.
"Just a little something I whipped up in my spare time. Wish I could give you more than a few seconds of burn, but at least it got us out of there."
and roasted the turtle's head, Jason said appreciatively. So what now?
Kill it,
Coach said.
You even have to ask? We got enough distance. We got ballisti. Lock and load, demigods.
Jason frowned.